Today's listener essay is by Jeannie Hunter.
What seems like, and in fact is, a lifetime ago, I watched entranced on a tiny black and white screen the first TV in our neighborhood, the 1947 wedding of Princess Elizabeth to her dashing Greek prince Philip. I was a schoolgirl, and this was still 6 years away from the pomp and circumstance of her coronation as Queen Elizabeth II, a vastly impressive display of all the glorious trappings decreed by such an occasion. After moving to Manhattan in 1961, I was made frequently aware that you can take the Brit out of London, but not London out of the Brit. My accent to this day has been either mocked or lauded. Last week, I brimmed with nostalgia over a PBS documentary on life within Buckingham Palace, fascinated to watch the royal butler prepare a unique cocktail preferred by Her Majesty, one-third gin, two-thirds Dubonnet, slice of lemon and two ice cubes, very similar to the preference of her mother, the revered Dowager Queen Mother, who was known to enjoy a drink at five every afternoon. This brought to mind a couple of tangential episodes I had had with that incredible institution known to the cognoscenti as the firm. While I was in London, the Queen's younger sister, Princess Margaret, was about to marry a society photographer named Anthony Armstrong Jones. Visiting the newsroom of a major newspaper a week before the event, I learned that there was to be a truly scurrilous story about the lifestyle of the groom and his best man. As I was aware that the wife of the best man was 8 months pregnant, and envisioning the appalling effect this story would have on the proceedings, I telephoned a family member of the best man and warned of the article. Immediately, lawyers were engaged to have the story squashed. 2 weeks after the wedding, I was getting ready to go to work when I got a phone call, and a highly cultured voice said he was calling on behalf of Her Majesty, who wished to thank me for my intervention on behalf of her sister, and that obviously, due to the delicate nature of the matter, her thanks could not be put in writing. For a while there, I was persona non grata with the news editor who leaked the story to me, but we subsequently became friends again. And then while living in Miami Beach in the early 80s, I relished the daily humorous column in the Miami Herald until one morning they ran a picture of Prince Charles being mauled by bikini-clad girls on the beach in Sydney, Australia. And the caption said, "Here's old Chuck slogging away at the awful burden being the next King of England," and so on. I climbed onto my high horse and wrote the columnist an irate note about his lack of respect and noting the deep affection the English held for the heir apparent. Then I sent a note to Buckingham Palace Press Office requesting a schedule of the Prince's events for the year. Back then, our mailman was a tall, blonde Dutchman whose dignity was only dented by his Bermuda shorts. He usually left the mail in a box outside the house, but this time he knocked, and when I opened the door, said in awed tones, "Mrs. Hunter, you have a letter from Buckingham Palace." Inside the envelope was a note of thanks from the press secretary, whose name was Dicky Arbiter, a name which jumped out at me recently when he retired. I forwarded the information to the columnist and received by return a note reading, "Dear Mrs. Hunter, nag, 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 devotedly, J.M. After which, any reference in his column to the Prince included every title he owned, His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales, the Duke of Cornwall, etc. Certainly tongue-in-cheek, but fine with me. The third incident seemed initially something of a disappointment, but eventually was worked out. At a trendy bar on Madison Avenue in Manhattan, I was disturbed to see at the entrance a large oil painting of Prince Charles in full polo regalia on his pony. This seemed to associate him with the establishment, and I sent a note to the consul, who replied that nothing could be done about images of the royal family on private property. A month later, I was pleased to see that the painting had been replaced by something more innocuous, possibly the result of some discreet manoeuvrings by the New York consulate. On hearing these anecdotes, it would be reasonable to assume that I am a busybody with nothing better to do, but I have long taken for my mantra a sign written in large Gothic script on the desk of director Stanley Kubrick in London, which said, "Anything that's fair."
Jeannie Hunter lives in Catskill, New York. To hear this or any roundtable segment again, visit WAMC.org.